I would like to welcome everyone to today's panel session. The title here is Harvesting the Business Value of Ontologies. This is session number two, even more case examples. We're going to have a full lineup of speakers, so I'm not going to introduce for very long. But this is a part of the virtual session, the Ontology Summit for 2011. And today's speakers include Dave McComb, the CEO of Semantic Arts, Ralph Hodgson, senior executive with Top Quadrant, Sanjizo Nash, who's the CEO from Z Agile, Jim Ryan and Lisa Kendall from Sandpiper Software, Jan Zossman from Franz, and Corey Kasanova from Model Driven Solutions. Our speaking order is roughly as you see on the wiki page. Our first speaker is Dave McComb. So ontologies at work at various organizations. David, welcome.
Great. Thank you. Well, I've got a lot of slides, so we're going to move briskly so we can leave time at the end for Q&A. We're going to look at three case studies. Let's go to the next slide. So we're just a small consulting firm. Most of what we do is work with semantic technologies and mostly helping large organizations with their enterprise architectures and semantic technology. Next slide, slide three coming up. Here's kind of a list of the clients we've worked with in the last decade. Next slide. Slide four. We're going to talk about Sallie Mae first. Next slide. Five. So Sallie Mae, if you don't have kids in college, you might not know they're the leading provider of student loans. In late 08, but mostly the winter of 09, we worked with them and built an enterprise ontology. They had several thoughts of what they were going to use it for initially. But then in late 2009, some things changed, and it presented a new opportunity with sort of where to deal with that. So slide six. this is kind of a summary of what they had in four of their key internal existing systems. These are loan origination, loan servicing kinds of systems. They just have, your classic internal system names. But one of the things I wanted to kind of point out, and this is very typical in large organizations, these four out of probably hundreds of their applications had 1,500 tables and 51,000 attributes between them. So, a fair level of complexity. These are custom-built systems, so it's kind of grown over time in the way that systems do. So if we go on to the next slide. So you built these ontologies. You can't actually read the cryptic things on the left there, but they're each visual representations of parts of their ontology. And sum total, there's just under 600 classes and several hundred properties to describe what we believed at the time to be all the key concepts and all the key distinctions that needed to be made at an enterprise level. In other words, at the level where they had to interchange information between systems, and a total of about 1,400 T-box axioms in total. This was, restrictions and subclass kinds of axioms, things like that. So what they were intending to do, they wanted a formal business definition so they could use this as the basis for agreement and future use. They wanted to validate some of their existing models and the like. And initially, the impetus was to integrate some structured and unstructured information, which is kind of a common theme these days. That got put slightly on hold with the events of the next slide here, slide eight. A part of their business had decided to go into a new line of student loan types of loans and decided to outsource the servicing of that to a third-party outsourcing company. But in the act of doing that, they realized that they had literally dozens of customer-facing applications, some of which were web and browser-based, direct to customers, some were to schools and various other institutions, and, of course, a whole bunch of them to customer service and various other folks who were proxies for the third party. And they realized that if they didn't do anything differently, they were going to end up with a whole new set of user interfaces, terms, transactions, processes, et cetera, et cetera. So they decided to take this opportunity to use the enterprise ontology and drive out consistency in their SOA environment. They had a pretty mature SOA environment, but mostly, as is common, a lot of point-to-point messages. So next slide, slide 9. So in the act of doing that, we had to dive into a bit more detail, not only to the new system, but to a next level of detail of the existing systems. This kind of blew out some of the class definitions in the second version of this, although a lot of it, as you can see in the bottom, was concepts that were specific to this message model, and we chose to detail out what was originally only one attribute in their system ended up being 130 classes in the ontology, which is explaining what their financial transaction codes meant. Next slide. So on slide 10, interestingly, as we blew this out, the number of properties didn't increase very much at all, which we find interesting and refreshing. Slide 11. Next slide. Here's kind of a high-level graphic of what was going on. We build our ontologies in a plug-in to Visio. It generates the OWL, which we then import into Protégé and TopGrade for different kinds of post-processing. And we were using Pellet and Pellint. Next slide. This is just to kind of get a common enterprise ontology. But where we wanted to go from there was to turn this into SOA messages. This one's an example from another client, but the basic idea is take part of an ontology, blow it out hierarchically, and get to an SOA payload. So the next message, what we chose to do on slide 13, because they had already acquired a product called Dixie from a company called Progress, we suggested they actually use this for this purpose, and it turned out to be a great match. We were able to extract the ontology into what Dixie calls the canonical logical model and use that for the definition of the SOA payloads. So we can go on to the next slide, number 14. And this originally was one of those build slides, so I just have to describe it. I got a little obscured there. But so what happened through the course of the project was people were still discovering what the messages in the new system and even some of the payload in the old system actually meant, these created change requests. People had to analyze them and figure out what does this field actually mean. But once we got through that, it was just a matter of incorporating it into the ontology, then blowing the ontology out through OWL, through the various, top quadrant pellet, et cetera, into Dixie. And Dixie had a very nice change detection and versioning of the messages, and you generate the next set of SOA messages. And that, what I think was sort of significant was that loop typically took 1 to 3 hours. So from the time a change, realized what sort of change you wanted to make till it was available for the messages was tight enough that you could make this work even kind of in an industrial environment. So next slide, number 15. And that result, they were able to use that. They got that system into production. In a lot of ways, I don't think the rationalization of the messages would have happened without the ontology. You can imagine that it would intellectually, but we really think it was kind of a forcing function that brought it all together, and changes could be rapidly incorporated. So let's go on to the next slide, slide 16. Procter & Gamble, slide 17. They probably need no introduction. A large multinational consumer products company. This was in. Can we get the next slide? This was in their research and development organization, which is large even by itself, about 10,000 researchers. More significantly, to our purpose, in about 100 different disciplines, and every research discipline has its own literal language, and they're inventing different kinds of stuff. So what they wanted to do was find some way that they could do searches across disciplines and capture knowledge of researchers that are leaving the organization. Next slide. So what we did, we built an enterprise ontology with them in their research and development domain, and did that in parallel with exit interviews for two of the research areas where they were reorganizing Duracell and Oral-B, the toothbrush folks. Next slide, number 19. So there were several different models. We used our upper-level ontology called GIST as the basis for it. We also built out a scientific methodology ontology because a lot of the research does, as you might imagine, follow normal scientific principles. They also had a large common research and development ontology of the shared concepts that they had throughout the organization, as well as their project management kinds of methodologies. That was the FEI. And then Duracell and Oral-B each specialized all the things up above that. So next slide, slide 20. What we found there, so we had the basic classes and properties in GIST. In the shared part of the R&D ontology, we just about doubled the number of classes, but only increased the number of properties by about 10%. And then when we went out to the Duracell and Oral-B, again, you know, because you have to define batteries and toothbrushes and elastomers and all that kind of stuff, you get a lot more classes, but there's not a lot more properties needed to distinguish those classes from each other. So next slide, 21. So there's about 300 classes in that ontology, and when we're all said and done, it was sort of interesting. There were two that were not really directly derivable from our upper ontology. It was brands and inventions, and we just said, okay, those are different things. But what was interesting was the R&D folks could do queries across domains without having to learn all of the specific knowledge in each of the specific domains because of the shared classes at the top level and the number of shared properties. Most queries didn't require specialized knowledge. So next slide, 22. They built a semantic wiki on that. They've been working out a couple other domains and plan to do some additional work on that this year. So next slide, 23. Brings us to LexisNexis. Next slide, 24. They are a leading supplier of legal and other research. A lot of what they have to do is either done by hand or by heart, handwritten scripts. And they have launched an initiative to greatly improve what they're doing in legal text search. Next slide, 25. So they've got some very interesting technology for processing the raw text and extracting not just entities, but also the relationships that are implied by those entities in the legal text. And we're going to be doing that and conforming it to the new enterprise ontology, which we're building right now. Next slide, 26. So they've got, as many other people do, usually we draw these pictures for people, but they already had it. That's their existing architecture. Next slide. In the process of doing this, they've done an incredible amount of modeling and schema development and logical modeling and stuff. One of the main things that we've come up with lately is just a better way of organizing the number of either models or ontologies being built. And here we call this our tic-tac-toe board of just separating real-world models from design artifacts and implementation artifacts and instances, metadata, and grammars. So next slide, number 28. What we got into just touched into is what we call the deep modeling, not modeling the structure of these documents, but you know, what does a law really mean, and what did a case really turn on? So we're just in the very early days of that, but that's where we think the exciting long-term win is. If we can go on to number 29, that's the summary. Then I was trying to wrap in my time limit here. I think I hit pretty close. There's the three case studies. Each did very interesting and sort of different things in the enterprise context, and each built from a common upper ontology. So with that, Mills, I'm going to turn it back, and I'll be on the line and available for Q&A at the end.
Okay. Just one quick question, Dave. You mentioned the use of Semantic Media Wiki.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, could you elaborate on that just a second?
Not a lot, because they actually did it, and we were only very passively involved with it. So anything I'd say would be kind of speculative.
Okay.
They were using our ontology, but I didn't get very involved in it.
Okay, great. We'll come back, you know, in the Q&A with some more. Thank you very much, Dave. Ralph Hodgson has quite a rich presentation about many of the case examples that have come from their experience.
Thanks.
Go, Ralph.
First of all, I want to say I struggled with the words here on the first title. I show a graphic here. I'm very interested in graphics, so this is one that intrigued me, you know, the way we connect the dots, the themes that come out of it. Why do people want enterprise architectures? Why do they want semantic technology? And I wanted, to, of course, to play with the words that were in the theme of this session, so I turned them around various ways and ended up with valuing harvested ontologies, but I didn't have time to write. That's a very interesting project in its own right because of commonality variability concerns across the various efforts that the industry is taking here on ontology. It's crazy that we have so many people going, you know, with this stuff, but the competitors have to kind of work in strange ways in the early market, and I really look forward to the day when we can combine our efforts on things without any fears and not look over our shoulder. And those days are maybe further on. But having said that, you see why I have this little balance here. I got to watch the clock and not dive deep on anything, so that'll come up, and many of these slides will leave behind. So I've now morphed this into valuing the harvest from using ontologies, which is really a personal reflection on I'm concentrating on value. What is it we're getting from using this stuff? And with that, I'll move to slide 2. And just to say who I am, and that this complexity is something that I've faced all my life. It started in HP when I was designing instruments for telecommunications, putting things into 4K of RAM, for ROM, sorry, into PROMs. Now it's about how to deal with all these complex information spaces and help the guy on the right. So with that, the next slide, which really we can move on. I think everyone knows who Top Quadrant is. We consult as well as do platforms, so let's move on from that. The kinds of solutions that people are building with this technology and getting value from are vocabulary, building message structures, generating XML from ontologies. I don't want to confuse people by saying that ontologies have very different meanings in the industry, and you can view ontology as rich theories and micro theories of domains, ontologies of, I'd say, or ontologies about, you could come to another level, or you can simply think of them as better ways of working in the XML world or in the UML world even, better, or ER world, better ways of doing models that can be executed directly as triples. So there's a lot of need here to disambiguate what it is we're talking about when we say the ontology word. The next piece here, data integration, we've seen here is the value of using this to make connections between data locked in different silos. That's been a tremendous insight, just how well this technology works for that. And, of course, we see enterprise architecture, which is simply, you know, we want to have a way to understand how the business is and how it needs support from various IT, bridging those worlds. And the success, I think what I've learned here is that the success of this is that we have finally a way for the IT people and the business people to connect their worlds, to find a way to – I'm doing that right now, actually. Today I'm working on some banking stuff where – I'm intrigued by the thought that it is about that, that it's about being able to make that connection from enterprise, from business notions of enterprise to IT notions of enterprise and software systems and databases. Next slide. So I try to think about, you know, all this insight over the last 10 years, or it's greater than 10, I think. It has led me to this picture where I'm putting a 2x2 together. What have we learned about the way people use this stuff? And in the bottom sorry, in the vertical direction, we see the role of models. Are they weak or strong? In the horizontal direction, we see ontologies as design artifacts or ontologies as runtime artifacts. The hard states is up there in the top right quadrant, the number 10, where we want to have model-driven applications as a read-write. Much of the semantic web right now is in number 8, where things are read-only, or even number 7, where it's about query response. But there are some interesting places on the intersection. You see the orchestration stuff on number 5. You see the control vocabulary stuff on number 4. And now the value, coming back to the personal reflection on this, is that there's so many ways of using RDF and OWL and Sparkle that it's really, getting very interesting figuring out how to even make sense of the big conferences like Semantic Technology Conference. What is it that is busy with these days? Is it busy with all of these spaces? Is it busy with just search aspects of this? There's some interesting positioning to be figuring out here. I do have a lot going on the left where we are transforming things, generating other things to live in the XML ecology. But our own use, now that we have our tools and platforms, is up in number 10. We're solving some very hard problems, and I'm kind of fascinated with the way we're seeing breakthroughs there. But I'll come on to that later. Next slide. So some case studies that much of these slides will leave behind, that we're seeing a lot of interest in intelligence agencies, Air Force, recovery work going on there. FAA, NextGen is a big user of ontologies. That's going to touch all kinds of domains. Eli Lilly, we've done some interesting work on antibodies discovery, and then there's a very different thing happening on that Johnson & Johnson Vistacom thing where we're actually using ontologies for real-time production monitoring in SCADA, so supervisor control and data acquisition setting, which is my background actually. But the interesting thing here is, how can we push this down to the leaves? Can we put this on the factory floor in some way? And I think there are interesting applications and challenges there. The insight I get from that, we'll touch later if we have time. We have call center things happening, and I mentioned ourselves as a user. I'm very much in the using our stuff mode in the company, so I'll tell you about our bug tracker and how that we've got value from doing that with our own tools. Eating our own dog food. Next slide is a slide which says what I kind of boil down the value of semantic web technology to when I'm asked to speak in 5 minutes or in the elevator about this. So are these four things: canonical data, getting things into triples as soon as you can, having identifiers on every one of those triples, having schemas in such a way that they can be queried with the same language of the data is a huge hit, a huge big thing, because it lets you do all of the connection, the dots kind of stuff. Evolvability, that's really what we get out of this technology, much more than any relational database. The schemas, vocabularies, and data sets can all evolve. And we need ontology architectures that separate these different graphs. And that's another insight that I value from the harvesting that we've been doing of our own experiences. So next slide. Next slide tries to position the kinds of things people do in another 2x2 here. Again, it's a leave behind. Our book on capability cases sets the kind of methodology in place for thinking about things in this way. Putting noun phrases on the kind of things people do, like concept-based search, is really what's going on here. Generative documentation and generative information structures is a very big thing that we're busy with. So there you have things to think about later. look at where Web 2.0 stuff is. It's in the bottom. It's informal. But we have to live with it. We have to have a way to figure out how 3.0 meets 2.0. And the insight I get from that needs another half hour, I think. But we can leave that for later. Next slide. Next slide is typically shown when we want to explain what's going on for people, that you, this technology is about making that stuff on the right play together. Now, it's about having the hub in the middle of that picture, driven by ontology. It's about those guys on the left being able to customize the system in very flexible ways. So those are the things that I've learned are important to talk about. The integration, the ability to model drive, everything at the core to get things into neutral models, and the ability to make very rich user interfaces against that. Next slide. So we often will find ourselves talking about connecting the dots, breaking out of these various sources. Next slide. It means different things. We have to distinguish what connecting the dots means. And this is in order of difficulty. The 360-degree view, more about the same thing, is the easiest to do. Transitive connections is what is linked to what. We are following the connections between things. The hardest thing to do that is, in my experience, is information discovery, finding things that share common attributes or relationships. And doing that in a scalable way is really where a lot of the interest is in the life sciences and to some extent telecommunications industry. And in all markets of business intelligence applications, you will find an interest in three. Cyber intelligence is a... It's also about that, but it's helpful if you can just get one done, yeah? Next slide. So what the challenge, what I've learned is when we go through this process of taking triples from various sources, we ingest them, we normalize against the model, we expurgate or explore that in various ways. You've got visualization there, you've got statistical analysis on the next matrix-looking thing. You use that in order to make decisions and then act. And this was done for some cyber intelligence kind of presentation I made. The big challenge I've learned is when you brought this data into triples, is it reasonable to operate on that with typically matrix computations? Statistical packages do a better job of that. So how do you take your triples or any semantic representation and put it in a different format in a huge way for other things to work on? And one of the things that happens in the social network analysis work is to show a plot like you see in the 1, 2, 3, 4th column over. That plot is showing eigenvector value against betweenness to look at where clustering is happening. Is it reasonable to do that in triples? And we are seeing with the entry of Cray into this space, it might be. It might be possible to do very efficient operations across triples to do statistical analysis. But in my NASA work, I wasn't advocating that we do matrix arithmetic or anything like that in triples, and we have to hand off to different things. That's a value or a non-value that I come to realize. Yeah. Next slide. Is really a build slide. The blue stuff you see is what you get from connecting the dots. So if you know things that are set in black there, you can infer this because when someone marries someone in the Arab world, their tribes become aligned, and if one is a militant tribe, the other tribe is. So this is the kind of value that we get from simply connecting the dots and making simple inferences. Next slide. So we did this work to demonstrate this. We took all these sources in, and the value here was actually being able to automate this with not just the Sparkle rule stuff we are busy with, but also the Sparkle motion data flow language. We have this in a kind of orchestrated way, which is, keeps up to date with how these sources are. The next slide is another case study. This is a very interesting case study, finding antibodies across different databases, looking at those databases as if they were one database, a typical federated kind of 360-degree view thing. Next slide. We move to a visual representation of what's going on in that antibody search, just backing up that previous slide with a typical screenshot of how people are busy with this. The value of these visualizations that I've learned is it's not interesting when they're very busy pictures. It's interesting when you can apply operations over them, like show me how these two things are connected. Or, you know, I've explored here, place that in the basket or something like that, and let me explore somewhere else. So you have to have this strong interaction with these visualizations. And you have to do some clustering as well. So there's a statistical treatment of these things that's very important. Next slide. This is actually not from one of our customers. Well, it might be. I'm not sure if they're a customer of ours or not. But, well, yeah, yes, a part of NextGenR. But they're just using vocabularies here to align how people talk about, is this air temperature? Yeah, air temperature. And it's a typical case where ontologies are there to help you align what it is you're talking about. Next slide. NASA, much work I did there, and still I'm busy with QUDT, the unit's work. I'm busy with the telemetry commanding. This established ways of thinking about information architecture and thinking about coexistence between our RDS and XML, with our work on XML Schema Plus, a language for describing what XML schemas should look like. The next slide, I think, is also a NASA slide. It really just emphasizing what concept-based search is like. I think we all know what this is like. If I look for that search, failure corrections on mission STS-123, one that I actually saw when I went to Kennedy, a discrepancy report is something that might show up here because discrepancy and failure can be related, as can deviations and deviation waivers. So the concept-based search is a very hot spot for the way semantic technology gets used. My insight from this is you have to design similarity measures in context. You can't just do concept-based search without some similarity measure treatment. Yeah? Next slide. This is featuring the information architecture work we've been busy with, where we see mass properties, typically launch of a vehicle, burning propellant, dynamic stability changing over, while you're doing that, mass properties expressed in a time series array, that array defined in an ontology about time series and data and arrays and matrices, that living on the right there in a reference architecture of information. Next slide. Many insights there. Insight into how to live in the XML ecology is covered here with the interoperability thoughts between our own tools, and here's the XML spy. So much to what can I say to this picture other than the fact that you have to get into triples as soon as you can, and when you get out of them, you have to have annotations to help you on the way, because you're moving from a set theoretic world into a container-like world. You have to have a language which expresses what it means to be in expressing things in container and dealing with enumerations in various ways. Next slide. So this is our bug tracker. We eat our own dog food now. Now that we have our tools, we can use them. And we've been running this for over a year or even maybe 18 months now. But the value we get from this is its extensibility. When we add more to our product, we can change the ontology that drives this. Everything you see in this is driven from ontology, so we can grow not just the product side of this, but also the process. We represent our processes. We're being asked to be ISO 9000 compliant now, and we'll figure out how we can represent our adherence to that. Yeah. So having a way to construct this with ontologies has been enormously valuable. Being able to use the configuration side of this tool where all the wiring between components is expressed in ontologies is proven to be extremely valuable. So here we see ontologies not as series but as languages for expressing things that you might have done in UML or in data structures of various kinds. Next slide. This is some work that I did for DoD to demonstrate how you could take enterprise architecture models and BPMN models specifically into ontology. The vision that Dennis Wisnowski has here is that you can get rid of those adapters by having upstream people provide things in RDF. So all the sources on the left would have to comply with some standards for their models, and then you don't have to do any of these adapters. It's a grand vision, when he uses this slide, he crosses the adapter thing out, which is always very amusing for me. The next slide just gives you, I think, an example of how we put that together in Top Grade Ensemble. This was done in 2 hours. We built this application in about 2 hours over the models. Yeah, we're trying to get this environment into a form where anyone with no skills in ontologies could build their own environment over models. Yeah. Next slide. I think we're pretty much done. This is at MITRE. Yes, this is using Top Grade Ensemble for a cybersecurity ontology. And on the right, you see Ensemble being used to describe what's going on in the models on the left there. The insight I get from that is other people can do things quite quickly and without us noticing at times. It's quite interesting how this was reported in a paper that I think I referenced without the URL, but I can provide that. The next slide, I think, is netting things out into – oh, it's come up. No, it's fine. It's building. When I meet the different customer situations, you often will hear that they want to solve problem X, but this, as you indicated by the iceberg, it's often that's predicated on problem Y and problem Z, and we find ourselves doing different kinds of work, and this is one of the challenges, and how semantic technology can deliver or will deliver value will often be understanding what's beneath the surface, and I find that graphic quite appealing for that reason. But the common theme that you're going to hear, I think, not just from me but from every presenter, is aligning vocabularies, improving search, connecting the dots, actionable intelligence, and then this last one, which is generative information structures, which is, you know, how you take an ontology, transform it into schemas and vocabularies for other uses. And the little picture I have on the right there is from a Mantech presentation, which I find very intriguing, where this is actionable intelligence on cyber, it's on forensics, on digital forensics. Who would have thought that you would use ontologies for digital forensics? Well, turns out that there's quite a few people interested in that now, yeah? And they have a way of depicting how all these pieces of data get to be refined, if you like, and you have something at the end of all that process that you can act on. I think I'm done. My last slide is simply a little graphic. I kind of like the idea that we have to get back to work, and it takes so many days. In the past, it was like that. On the right, it's very different for some people, yeah? So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ralph. This is very informative and very stimulating kind of reflections. Because of our time pressures, we need to move on. Sanjeeva, so don't forget to call out the slide numbers, you know, as you go along so people can, you know, follow along.
Right.
Sanjeeva, you're on.
Okay, thank you. Well, greetings, everyone. I see quite a few familiar names, and I was hoping that maybe there was a different forum where we can be face-to-face and go out for beers later. But for today's presentation, and again, I appreciate this opportunity, what I wanted to talk about is certain facets or aspects of information chaos in enterprises where we are particularly focused in trying to create solutions out of semantic technology. And those are specifically related to methodology and process definitions and deployments and traceability. So slide two, please. So what I want to mostly cover here is talk about the traceability challenge. You know, how do we sort of see this in terms of a particular problem that we wanted to solve? And, you know, what is gives extreme traceability to us. You know, the architecture that's driven by ontologies, you know, the agile architecture of our tools and applications, and then also this kind of process automation architecture that we've come up with for easily deploying methodologies and then enacting them for specific projects across organizations. Slide three, please. So one of the starting points for us, you know, while the framework that we have and the technology is fairly applicable across the enterprise, we wanted to start out with a particular specific set of challenges related to software engineering because the chaos is more visible there and it's more impactful there. So let's look at some of this. I mean, you know, everyone's familiar with the issues here, obviously, but, you know, more specifically, some of the problems that we wanted to really address, you know, are these issues around traceability, the questions that are very, very difficult to answer for people. You know, for example, as you're starting to define product definitions, for instance, in terms of requirements, do you actually have an understanding of what the impact is? Who are the customers or stakeholders that are potentially out there benefiting from this stuff? And then at the other end, for example, once a product is released, is there a way to track revenue impact or anything almost, you know, like in terms of ROI or all the engineering efforts? So organizations across the board, I mean, in my career, I've seen, you know, a lot of them have very consistently struggled from this particular, you know, set of problems. And we're not just talking about revenue and product connections. We're talking about, you know, traceability across the board. Everything from, you know, who's asking for a specific product feature to be defined, what feature was defined, what was delivered, you know, how successfully was it delivered, and, you know, how successful it is in the marketplace, what's the quality of this, and on and on and on. So I think in terms of traceability, it's really, you know, connecting the full cycle here that has been very difficult for organizations, and that is really the problem overall that we have, you know, addressed with Zazzle. Let's see, slide four, please. So let's talk about extreme traceability. Now, you know, traceability in organizations tends to be siloed, so, and that's just it's sort of a defensive mechanism, if you will, because people will tell you, you know, of course they have, you know, lots and lots of reports. I mean, if you just talk about bugs, for example, or product quality, they have lots of reports that tell you what components have how many bugs and which bugs are being fixed and so on and so forth. The point here generally is really, I mean, there are two points. You know, one is that, first of all, the traceability is very siloed, meaning that it's at the departmental level. And second, I think more importantly, most of it is really generated manually. I mean, people assemble information from different sources and try to come up with their own, you know, Excel charts and spreadsheets and stuff. Where in extreme traceability, you really need to have to be able to achieve the end-to-end focus. You know, like where does it begin? I mean, what was the vision, marketing vision? What was the sales or customer need that drove the product cycle, for example? And how did it get delivered? And what kind of customer feedback and customer cases have been reported against it? So, I mean, it's the full cycle that really is critical in this. I mean, there's no limit to it, but also there needs to be a mechanism where it's not generated manually, but it's generated, but the information is captured in the system in a way that anyone can see any aspect of it at any time. Slide five, please. And so here, you know, there are some real significant issues within working groups in organizations. I mean, you know, what we call the trust area. And you see that all over the place manifesting itself in different ways. So, I mean, typically, you know, what I've seen, for example, trust barrier becoming issues are whatever information is thrown over the wall, if you will, across silos. You know, so between the business community and engineering, and then engineering and the customer community, for example, you know, those are the places where a lot of breakdowns occur. Whether the breakdowns are in people's lack of understanding of what is needed, or feedback was, or their lack of trust, if you will, or lack of a sense of security that they actually have what they need in order to accomplish, you know, their tasks relative to a particular project. Flight 6, please. So, in you know, from Zazzle's perspective, we took an approach, a model-driven approach, to solving this problem. And so I just wanted to point out some of the things in terms of why that's relevant and why we have become big believers in it. You know, first, you know, having the definitions, having a model underneath that's driving application, particularly in terms of process definition and enactment, we feel is very critical because it essentially ensures it not only ensures the enactment of a particular set of processes or methodologies, but it also allows you to then track any exceptions that occur along the way. And then the other thing is that, you know, given this meta-model approach, particularly since it is extensible, that you can also improve on it, and you can iterate through your processes and methodologies as you execute them so that as you find out things that work better, they can be redefined or added to the methodology itself. Slide 7, please. So let's talk about the architecture. So this is really actually the one before that. I'm sorry. Yeah, that one. So this is kind of an architecture view of our vision. It's basically, you know, down below you'll see the sort of the meta models or ontologies, if you will, that are representing various you know, core concepts: project quality, software configuration management, product teams, processes. So, I mean, the you know, one of the reasons why we chose this, I mean, the semantic technology to address this problem is because this was about the only way that we could represent multiple dimensions together. So, and this is something that is very, very difficult. I mean, I've not seen any application or tool set out there that is able to deliver that can capture process and collaboration and team elements at the same time. And so we started down with this repository, if you will, of software engineering ontologies that we've built. And then we've also built connectors to various tools. So part of this traceability challenge, which I didn't point out earlier, occurs because organizations typically consist of, you know, heterogeneous set of tools and stuff. So it's not just silos that are there because of departments and teams doing their own thing, but also because of the tools they use that don't interoperate. So in this particular model, you know, in Zazzle's vision, what we are achieving basically is that you can take whatever tools or applications you have within your organization, and using connectors that are easy to build, you can capture and integrate information from all of them. And then what comes out, as you can see on the right, is a very cohesive, comprehensive view of everything, of your world. So you'll see dashboards and stuff that become much more easily accessible and achievable, but on the boxes on the right, asset management, team management, product management, that's also our vision, that once you're able to have a very sort of cohesive information store, then you can build much richer applications from it. Because if you think about it currently, you know, each one of these boxes could represent a specific tool that still will not have any sort of level of integration or information from any other source. And so its ability and its functionality is still limited. Next slide, please. So now I'm on slide 8. And so more specifically, let's talk about kind of the component architecture, if you will, in terms of how we are doing what we're doing in terms of applying semantic technology. So what we have is basically, on the left, you'll see we built our ontology on top of this particular framework. It's a meta model for software engineering and development methodology, and it's and the spec is there, ISO 24744. I believe that it's really, we spent a lot of time on it. It's very a rich mental model, and it's not actually specific to development methodologies. I mean, it's abstract enough that you can use it for building bridges, but it is focused here and in its definition on development methodologies. So we've basically extended this with application-specific ontologies. And so what you're looking at here is essentially the architecture where we have our method composer product, which allows you to define methodologies. It allows you to assemble methodologies through definition of method components, if you will. And it's sitting on Jedi interface and just PostgreSDB, for example. And then we're able to publish the methodology to something that is would be very easy, convenient, and common, like, for example, MediaWiki or any other wiki, for example. So that's a starting point for being able to achieve this. Slide 9, please. So once you have defined your methodologies and components and stuff, then we have the project builder, which then can allow you to pick any methodology and then instantiate your tool. So, so organizations that have hundreds or thousands of projects going on at the same time, I mean, normally the typical scenario is that they will take a project plan that exists and make a copy of it, and they will take documents or templates and make copies of them and so on and so forth, because there isn't a very easy mechanism that people have of saying, for this particular project, we're going to use XYZ methodology, and now we want all our tools to be set up automatically, appropriate to that methodology so that we can track it. I mean, that's just not very easy to do. So what this is allowing you to do is for you to choose a particular methodology that you want to instantiate for a project, and then it automatically will set the tools up appropriately. So everything that you define, however formal the methodology needs to be, whether it has stages or phases, whether it has certain processes defined, task dependencies, roles, et cetera, et cetera. So all those things are automatically configured here. Slide 10, please. So this is our project manager. This is the third step. I mean, this is, again, something that I have not seen any particular application in application lifecycle management achieved so far, is the fact that you can enact the methodology, configure your tools, and now you can, at runtime, capture the information from these tools to be able to see how a particular project has executed, how a particular methodology has worked, and what exceptions have been generated. I mean, this is something that I have heard from project managers and particularly in services-oriented organizations where they have 50, 100, 500 projects going on at the same time. They have very little visibility in terms of knowing how these projects are executing and where the potential gaps might be and who's done things differently that might actually, affect change to the methodology. So all of these things are achievable here because now, once the project has been instantiated and the tools are configured, at runtime you're capturing in the ontology all of that stuff, and so you're able to get essentially reporting and analytics from that information that tells you how you have executed and how well it's worked. Slide 11, please. So this is just to start showing you a little bit of what it looks like. I mean, beyond, block diagrams and stuff in the architecture, here's our implementation. So we have products that are allowing you to achieve that. And so here, this is basically what you're looking at is a form in a wiki. So if you kind of imagine, it's a little bit hard to read, but I'll just guide you through this. If you imagine the current wikis, for example, are typically, unstructured content, bunch of paragraphs on a page, this page here is representing a number of things. For example, you'll see that, you know, the title of the page, Hudson Test Case Suite, so it actually represents a, an instance of a category called Test Case Suite, and you'll see in the block on the right the category and what category is represented by the page itself. You'll also see some relations there. I mean, these are all properties, semantic properties driven by the ontology, so it's planned for a particular project. It belongs to a, another test suite, for example, so you can have sort of nested structure there. It has, you can have further typing and so on. So what you're looking at in this page is a mechanism that we provide now for people to capture semi-structured content driven by the underlying meta model. Again, just focusing on the model-driven approach. Down below, just extending this a little bit more, you'll see, for example, there's a test case and test steps that are defined. Each one of those also is an instance of a different category, and they're all related to this test case suite. So now, rather than having a page and a bunch of paragraphs, you've actually defined very, very specific entities and relationships between them and relationships of these entities to other things that exist within the system itself. So that's the level of structure that we're able to achieve with this so that you can start capturing this information and then tracking it across your project. And this is our product called Wicket Smart that allows you to do that. Slide 12, please. And again, because of time limitations, I just wanted to give you some sort of glimpses of this implementation. So here's the information dashboard. Now, normally something like that would be manually constructed or through some kind of template or whatever. This dashboard you're looking at, if you look at just below the title, it says View Properties Release 2.0. So Release 2.0 is an instance of a concept or category called release. And when you click on any release, for example, you'll see a dashboard view of that, which is automatically generated. And it will give you all of the sort of semantic properties laid out in some sort of visual. So everything from description, what project it's associated with, to what are its requirements, you know, and for each requirement, what do we know about it? What tasks are associated, you know, and so on. And down below, for every requirement, you know, what test case steps were executed, what was the status, when, and so on. And then you can also obviously capture the, you know, the charts and stuff. So one of the things we have done, for example, is, this is kind of starting to merge business intelligence with semantic technology. So we have integrated Jasper Reports. This is an open source federal library with our stuff, and now Jasper Reports supports Sparkle with our plugin. So you can use Sparkle to design very, very cool reports and, you know, create very rich dashboards, if you will. Slide 13, please. And then, of course, the manifestation. I mean, I heard that from Ralph earlier and, you know, possibly even Dave, but, I mean, everyone talks about search. You know, being able to, find things. So this is a faceted search or semantic concept-based search that we've implemented. So now you're still looking at a wiki, but instead of doing keyword searches or finding tags or keywords, if you look to the right, you actually can see in the power search mode a concept, in this case a test case. And because, again, it's a manifestation of a model-driven architecture, whatever concept you pick, it will go and find all of the relevant properties and give you this sort of filter, if you will. So we're looking for a test case. And if you look down below, we are looking for a test case that tests Hudson Connector, right? So it's somewhere like about halfway down. And so we are, you know, now we're able to look for specific things. I mean, not just anything that matches a particular keyword. I'm actually going to look for test cases that test Hudson Connector. And now, and what I get back on the left here is, first of all, only test cases. It doesn't matter whether they are, whether they're a paragraph on a page or they exist in a different tool. You know, the stuff that's here is not necessarily just represented in the wiki. It's represented in the repository down below, which could have come from anywhere. But what I'm getting back here is only test cases, but it's also giving me information about the test case. You know, again, the properties that are defined for it, you know, ID, description, what concept it's related to, what is the test. And you'll see, for example, this, you know, expanded box, which shows Hudson Connector, because in this case, the test case is showing its relationship to Hudson Connector components. And if you click on it, you will, it will expand the box, and it will tell you something about the Hudson Connector. So again, more examples of traceability here, meaning that, you know, you can have elemental traceability. You can look at any particular instance and know about its properties and then in, essentially navigate across the network of this integrated information. Let's see, slide 14, please. So just summarizing everything so far. I mean, you know, the problem has been there, obviously, that we wanted to tackle. I've experienced it throughout my career, which is, you know, the cost of project management, you know, the siloed tools and distributed environments, particularly when you have teams that are distributed across the globe, create a lot of problems in terms of collaboration and efficiency and cost. And also, processes are not trackable, and there's very little mechanism, you know, other than just managers spending their nights and weekends capturing information and trying to bring it together. So to me, that's really a very fundamental problem in the enterprise. I mean, we started with software engineering, although it's very applicable to other areas. And the solution, obviously, as you've seen, is this, you know, taken model-driven approach, the ontologies that are formally defining within the business context, at least we find it to be a lot easier. I mean, the semantics are fairly clear across businesses and across domains. Everybody knows what a project is. Everyone knows what a bug is. So, I mean, it's easier to create model-driven architectures that are a bit consistent in their application across organizations and across domains. And so we have taken that approach to allow people to capture methodologies and then track them and do that in very simple ways. I mean, as you saw in a wiki, for example, you can create test cases and relate them to things, and you can start tracking the execution. And, of course, the benefits, I mean, you know, obviously traceability and this level of being able to look at a comprehensive and sort of cohesive information store, you know, it facilitates better decisions. I mean, you know, if I'm a project manager or engineering manager and I need to understand where we sit in terms of our release delivery cycle, you know, I need an easy way to know, for example, what the quality is, what's tested, what's not tested, what's our risk, and so on. And those are the things that we've struggled with in our career. So, I mean, that's essentially, I think, is one of the most significant aspects of this. And, but also, I believe that, you know, for organizations that are, you know, executing, as I said, dozens or hundreds of projects at the same time, the overall cost of project management could be very significantly reduced as a result of that because, you know, the cost of capturing and gathering all the information is quite tremendous, and it can be anywhere from 20 to 30% of their overall project effort. So anyway, and slide 15, please. Well, this is just our Zazzle. I haven't talked about Zazzle, but we have a sandbox. If anybody's interested, I'm happy to answer questions, but you can also go and play with it and try it out and see how our architecture works. So thank you, Nelson. Thank you, everyone.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we'll, you know, we'll come back with some questions, I believe, you know, a little bit later on. Okay, great. Thank you. Next up, Lisa and Jim Ryan. Lisa Kendall.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Ryan. My colleague, Lisa Kendall, is also on the call. And let me start off by talking a little bit about Sandpiper Software. It's a small consulting and technology company on the West Coast. We do semantic technology consulting. We build software tools. The primary tool that we have is something called the Visual Ontology Modeler, which is based on the ODM standard for modeling OWL and RDF in UML. We also do ontology development, and we do custom semantic solution architecture. All right. When Mills sent us the request to do a case study, he asked for specifically a format of a quadrant slide that addressed four different topics: challenge, the solution, key ontology features, and business benefit. And because as a company we believe in paying serious attention to our client requirements, we in fact presented a slide set with one single slide in. So you won't have any problem following the slides, and I don't think there'd be any need to call out the slide numbers. All right, with that out of the way, let me talk a bit about the challenge, okay? The title of the talk really says what the domain area is. It's applications of semantic technology in rental product marketing. And I put the word rental in there for a reason that I'll get to later. But the challenges, there are two main challenges. One is to help consumers find offerings, and the other challenge is to help consumers select offerings. Now, if you look at how people find things, and we're talking here about on the Internet as opposed to getting in your car and driving down to the shopping center, there are basically three routes. People either go to a known site, for example, Amazon, and at the Amazon site, you can get Amazon's price for an item if you know how to find it, and you can also get lots of information about the item. So that's the value point that is provided by a reseller, an Internet reseller like Amazon. You can also use the search engine. You can go to Google and you can search for cameras, or you can search for DVDs. You can find a lot of suppliers there. It may be difficult to use the search engine to find things that are odd or don't have very well-known descriptive terms, there's really not a lot of information that would help you pick a particular supplier other than price. You may have to do some auxiliary investigation to find out how reliable the supplier actually is. The third thing you can do is you can go to what's called an aggregator site. And for example of that, you can look at things like PriceScan.com. These sites are comparison sites, and they're generally used by people who are looking for commodity items or well-known brand items with multiple supply channels. And the consumer typically is looking to see which one of the suppliers is offering the best price today. In terms of selecting offerings, people in many cases are looking for something that doesn't have a ready description. If you're looking for DVDs or if you're looking for video cameras, these are things where what the reference of those terms are pretty well established in people's minds. But if you're looking for something odd, like a tool for washing windows, that's a little bit harder to find. Okay? And once you've found these things, then the question is, well, which one do you want? What kind of features does it need to have? What kinds of things can it be used for? And from the merchant's point of view, it may be that the merchant wants to engage in some marketing activity with the purpose of doing upselling. In other words, what the seller is saying is that you can get an item of better quality and with more features, and the price will be slightly higher. Okay, so that's the business level challenge, and the kinds of solutions that we want to bring to those challenges are threefold. We want to have semantic aided search. When people go to search for things, they want to be able to use how they think about the thing that they're searching for in order to try to find it. And so we're going to use semantics together with some natural language processing to try to map the consumer's expression of what they're looking for into something that we know about. Because a lot of people use search engines, and search engines today are not driven by any kind of externally controllable semantic, but they are driven by increasingly by invisible data called microformats that are embedded in web pages that the search engine crawlers and the indexing engines actually look at. And so one of the things that we want to be able to do is to use semantics to create a lot of structured data that sellers can then put in their websites. And it makes it easier for the search engines to identify the actual content of a site. And it gives the seller an opportunity to indicate many more categories that the item that they have for sale or for rent is capable of being used for. And then finally, you want to use semantics to do rule-based product selection. Now, I promised a little bit earlier to talk about rental offerings, and the problem here is most of the attention that's been paid on the web has been paid to simple sale transactions. And so you can find things like Google Rich Snippets and H-Product Microformat and Good Relations RDFA, which is derived from the Good Relations ontology. And these things generally don't work well for rental businesses. First of all, they have multiple prices, and the prices are going to depend nonlinearly on the rental duration. And the reason for that is that most rental businesses involve some fixed check-in and check-out costs. And the longer the item is out on rental, the better you can do about amortizing the fixed costs against the higher revenue that's come from an item out on longer duration. And so renters tend to provide discounts on items that are rented for longer durations because of this. Secondly, the price may depend on a whole bunch of factors like, you know, what season we're in, where is the item being rented, what's the local demand like, what's the creditworthiness of the renter, okay? And the final point that I'll mention are that rentals are generally governed by contracts, unlike simple sales. And the contracts tend to stipulate future behaviors that the consumers are interested in, like, you know, what happens if the item that I rented breaks or it doesn't function the way it's supposed to? Is there a penalty for bringing it back early? What happens if I don't bring it back, if I lose it, okay, and things like that. And the shoppers want to see these kinds of contract details, which are not very well covered in existing structured data or microformats. So what we're doing is, first of all, we're building an ontology for a rental enterprise to support the three solutions, semantic-aided search, semantic-aided search engine optimization, and rule-based product selection, including things like eligible deals, upsell, and cross-sell. And an example of cross-sell, for example, it's fairly common in the rental business for the renter to offer you some insurance on the item that you've just rented, and you pay a fixed fee for that, and it essentially covers any losses that you might otherwise be responsible for according to the contract. So a little bit about the ontology characteristics. The ontology that we're building is a combination of LDL and SWIRL, and the SWIRL stuff is there to handle some of the kind of closed world restrictions that we need to have that can't be handled by LDL reasoners and realizers. It's a complex multi-entity ontology. It covers topics like contracts, offers, price structures, rental items, validity dates, and a whole lot of other topics too numerous for me to mention. There are a lot of restriction axioms and other kinds of axioms that and incorporate the real semantics of these kinds of offerings. And this is very important. So, for example, we have specific types of relationships between offers and contracts. we have different kinds of contracts depending on whether the contract is being used to advertise information about an offer or whether the contract is being used in, for example, an actual rental contract environment where typically you would need a lot more information, including information about the identity of the renter. It's not needed if you're just simply advertising a contract on the Internet. Then there are all sorts of eligibility requirements on some kinds of rental contracts. Now, one of the interesting things here is that classification and realization are actually part of the application process around Internet marketing. There are some things where there are some sort of marketing situations where the classification of the ontology, which is fairly compute intensive, can be done offline, and the fully classified ontology is just simply used for doing realization or for doing rule-based processing. The work that we've been doing that I'm talking about so far is a pilot project, and so we don't really have any hard information that we can give you about the business value, but in terms of where we would look for business value, I'll say the following. If this endeavor is successful, the intent is to drive a lot more consumer use of the Internet channel, and as an auxiliary to that, to take away market share from competitors in the marketplace by providing an Internet site that is easier to use, that tends to give better shopping results than the competitors do. So eventually we would get some numbers from this particular enterprise that we're working for that indicate the degree of business success that they're having. There's a secondary benefit that comes from the search engine providers themselves. And that is that, again, if we're successful here, this will open up a new, if you will, marketing regimen for folks like Google and Bing, which today don't cover this kind of business very well in the stuff that they look for. And this is going to be valuable to them in terms of the way they compete in their own marketplace. And it will also enable them to better serve the consumers that they have. And finally, the benefit of having an ontology that covers these kinds of rental situations is that it, in effect, creates a common semantics for rentals that makes it easier for consumers to understand and compare offerings, which is something that's a bit difficult to do today. And so you can think about, for example, representing the contents of the ontology in some sort of a browser or in, for example, something like a semantic media wiki presentation that would basically be an information site for consumers that are interested in certain kinds of items to rent. And that's all I have.
I have one more comment on the benefit, Jim, just that I'm thinking and going Ralph and that Sanjay said is that the level of flexibility that we're providing in terms of using an ontology-based approach here, first not only allows you to pose and answer questions people couldn't answer using traditional technology, but moreover is much easier and more flexible to change. And when you're talking about promotions from a marketing perspective, which are changing almost daily, and you're attempting to shove stuff out through some of the search engine providers, et cetera, being able to make those changes really, really quickly and flexibly without having any of that stuff hard-coded, but rather pushing it through your ontology and their instantiation could turn out to be a big deal, and again, stay tuned on that.
Super. Yeah, no, where Sanjeeva is talking about the user experience of people, you know, doing knowledge work, you guys are targeting consumer user experience, you know, both in its initial instance and ability to continue to be relevant. I love it. We've got to move on. Next, Jan Zossmann from France, you're on.
Okay. I will talk about the customer, our biggest customer that we have, which is the is MDocs. It's a system that right now is in production and being tested with real customers. And what I'm showing you here is a presentation that MDocs in France gave to Gartner to talk about the role of semantic technology in CRM. So let's go to the next slide, number two. So MDocs is a customer. it's the biggest third-party billing company in the world, meaning that for the most big operators in the world, they take care of their billing. So instead of a telecom doing their own billing, it's probably much better to have a specialist do the billing for you. And they're also very, very big in CRM software. So they deliver software to main telecoms, and they also do the outsourcing. So, for example, a company like Sprint does all the call center operators. It is done by MDocs. So MDocs is in this fairly competitive situation because there's a lot of players in this field of wanting to do third-party billing and doing CRM software. So they needed something new. And if you look at the world of telecom, then what you see is that their biggest problem is to retain customer and to prevent customer churn. Yeah. So once you have a customer, you want to invest actually a lot to make sure that the customer doesn't go to your competitor. And in order to retain your customer, you want to treat your customer as nice as you can. Yeah. But in order to do so, you really need to know everything you can about that one particular customer. And so what MDocs did is they decided to build what they call a semantic platform where the ultimate goal is to know everything they can about a single customer. And the representation of what they know about an individual customer is stored in a triple store or is stored as triples. So I'm going to talk about that particular semantic platform. So the paradigm that they were looking for is that you want to look at what – sorry, I'm going to slide number three. Yeah. So basically what you want, a platform where you can see everything the customer does, you understand what the customer was trying to do, his preferences, things he likes, things he doesn't like, and then you take the right action. And it doesn't only apply to customers, it also applies to the devices that he uses. So if you see that his email is not working on his smartphone, well, then instead of waiting till the customer calls, what you could do is because you have a heartbeat monitor for devices, you could notice that and then you could send the customer, you could proactively solve it. You could call him or you could just fix it on his phone. So this is what they call the See, Think, Act paradigm. And the requirements for this semantic platform are enormous. I mean, the biggest telecoms in the world, say, for example, they have as a customer China Telecom, and they have more than 500 million customers. I mean, a customer like AT&T is just a dwarf compared to that. Yeah. And every customer, say you have a customer, that customer will generate at least 10 events a day. And nowadays with smartphones, even more. Yeah. So when you make a telephone call, it's an event. But when you download something from iTunes, it's an event. Even when you go to your calendar and want to see something, it's an event. So with the advent of smartphones, I mean, 10 is even a low number of the things that happen per day for a particular customer. And what you want to do is you want to look at the events generated by the customer, and in many cases, you want a very fast response time. Yes, so one of the requirements to have 100 millisecond response time to certain events, obviously not to all events, but definitely to some events. So MDocs is working for a bunch of telecoms. And they can't control what their customers, whether it's an AT&T, a Sprint, a Verizon, or whatever, is doing with their platform. What they wanted is that their
customers could have their own business policies. So when events happen, these events are interpreted within the context of the business policies of a particular telecom. So you want a flexible system where you as MDocs can't predict kind of the ontology that your customers are going to use. So you want to be very, very flexible in that. So that was another requirement. And, of course, it has to be extremely cheap. 5.5. So this was the architecture that they have and that's now implemented and being tested. So what you see here is on the left-hand side the ingest. So MDocs is, as I said before, working with really large customers. And if you look at a telephone infrastructure, then there's about 20 different relational databases that play a role and event streams while maintaining your telecom infrastructure. Actually, there's thousands of databases in these big telecoms, but there's about 20 main ones. And so what they did is they said, okay, so we're not going to take all the events that we have and turn them into triples, but we're going to look at every event, and then some of these events will abstract and reduce a little bit and then turn those into triples. Yeah, so they take all these relational databases, for example, a CRM database or an ordering database. You take an event like I order a phone, and in the original database might have at least 40, 50 fields for me ordering this particular phone, but they'll probably get something like 20, 30 triples for that particular event. And the kind of triples that you get out of this relational database is determined by an ontology. Yeah, so they wrote an ontology of how they want to represent the particular telecom events. And that happens in the MDocs event collector. Yeah, so all these different databases, and what you do is you take a subset of your data. So you still leave all the data in your relational databases. And that is, by the way, a pattern that we see with many of our customers. No one is throwing away their relational databases. But what they do is they will add new smart databases to it, smart databases in the form of triple stores. So you have these relational databases. You should turn events into triples. And then triples goes into heart of decision, the heart of the system, which they call the decision engine. So triples come in, and these triples go into a semantic inference engine and business rule system. Now, what that means is that you get a particular event. For example, one event might be that on the first of the month you do not pay your bill. Yeah, so not paying something or not doing something is also an event in these systems. And so that's that event will get into the inference engine. And what the inference engine will do is say, okay, what do I know about the customer right now? So it will go into the triple store, in this case a Lego graph, and we say, give me all the triples for this particular customer. It will then look at the payment history for this particular person, so it will have a whole set of rules in memory for how to deal with events. And it will say, okay, well, the payment, he was already a moderately good payer, but he didn't pay, so let's make him a almost bad payer. So what actually happens is they take raw events that describe facts and turn it into what they call higher-level concepts, where these higher-level concepts are in many cases purely subjective or something like temporal or geospatial or a prediction. Anyway, so we have events. We turn them into higher-level concepts. And then another thing that they do is that they not only reason symbolically about the data, but they also want to use statistics to see that, say, given all the events that come in about you as your particular customer, what is the your future behavior going to be? So after these slides, I will start talking about one application of this platform, which is CRM. And so, for example, they're very interested to know what you're going to call about, or whether you will go into whether you're not going to bill, for example, not going to pay your bill, or maybe whether you will go to another company. So what they do is they take your data, all the triples about you, mix it up with information from other customers in roughly the same situation, and feed it through a Bayesian belief network. And that Bayesian belief network will, in its turn, generate new triples in the form of, the likelihood that he will pay is still about 40%, or the likelihood of him turning away from, say, Sprint to AT&T is 80%, whatever. And those triples then finally go into the triple store, and then when you need those triples, you will call them up. So this is roughly the AIDA runtime architecture. So let's continue. So a little bit more background. So let's go to slide 6. Okay, we're there already. Yeah, so as I said, they used a semantic concept model to kind of take events and turn them into concepts, and even go further, take the raw concepts and turn them in what they call higher level concepts, like a good payer versus a bad payer. And you guys can read this slide later, so let me actually continue a little bit. Can you go to the next slide? Okay, so this was actually a quick slide that they used for Gartner, because Gartner said, okay, so why didn't you use a relational database? And so I'm not here being a fan of particularly promoting Allegro Graph, but this is more in general. Why did you need to use a triple store for this instead of a relational database or a NoSQL database or multidimensional? And the slide is pretty clear. For MDocs, the most important reason to use a triple store to store data is because the data model that you have is completely dynamic. Yeah, MDocs will give this platform to other telephone companies, and these telephone companies will create their own business policies and their own high-level concepts. And you can't predict beforehand. And it would be just incredibly hard to make a system that would then start writing a relational database schema. So the dynamic data model works far best in a triple store. Doing inference is important in the system. And, again, that's something that works better in a triple store. The real-time part and the scalability part are still the things in triple stores that are not as well developed as relational and NoSQL. But for MDocs, all the other great features of semantic technology outweigh this problem with scalability. So for MDocs, what they actually did to overcome this problem of scalability, I mean, just imagine that you have an average telephone company with 100 million users, and each of them generate 10 events a day, and each event is about 20 to 30 triples. So within 2 or 3 months, you have a trillion triples. Yeah? So that's an enormous amount. So that's something you can't deal with in any single machine or in memory. So you have to run on tens and maybe hundreds of machines. And so they use a Java scalability platform called GigaSpaces to help with the whole scalability issue. Okay, so can we go to the next slide? Okay, so what I mentioned before is that MDocs built this semantic platform, but they're going to give it to their customers. Yeah, and their customers want to define their own business rules and their own policies. And they don't want to know about triples, yeah? If you have a typical telecom company, I mean, they just want the business value, and they couldn't care less whether it was done with semantic technology or not. So can you click one more time? Okay. I hope you guys can read this. Let me read my own screen here. You see things like an acquisition customer with some properties like an acquisition date, a status history, a type, a call frequency, a churn propensity, a collection risk. So here's a whole bunch of kind of lower-level concepts. It's entities, it's their properties. It's kind of a basic ontology. And everything is ultimately based on triples, but no customer will ever see a triple there. And then what the customer can do is in a very pretty user interface, create almost English rules to English language to create rules. So each of these little tiles is draggable. Yeah, so you can drag something from the left to into this sentences, and this will translate into rules and into Sparkle, and then we'll talk to a Sesame internal memory store or to the Allegro Graph, the larger Allegro Graph store. Yes, for example, here we see one rule. The top rule number one is find all of the previous bills within the last 6 months, and if all bills have a payment timeliness equal to early, then the payment pattern is a good payer. And otherwise, if all bills have payment timelines equal to late, then the payment pattern is the bad payer, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so you can make fairly complicated rules and never talk about ontologies, never talk about triples, but underneath, everything is implemented in triples. Can we go to the next slide? I want that. No, we're on slide 11. Yeah, slide 11. Yeah, okay. So Amdocs has created this semantic platform. They have everything in place, so they have the Bayesian Belief Network trained, they have Allegro Graph running with the data, they have the whole rule-based system running. They now run this routinely on a set of customers. So now there's a whole slew of services that you can run on top of that. And the first low-hanging fruit was to work on CRM. So telephone companies are currently in a difficult situation, given that they have these wonderful new smartphones that are on the market, the iPhones and the Androids. And in the last 5 years, the number of calls to call centers has quadrupled, yeah? Because, I mean, when we had our old phones where we only could make a phone call, I mean, roughly the one thing you can call about is that you complain about the bill. But nowadays, there's a million things you can complain about, yeah, and a million things you could like to, you want, might want to have some explanation about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and if you, so one of the things that they established is that if you call a call center, it's going to take about 10 minutes to solve your problem. The call center operator has to go through about 68 screens on average. And if you call, the profit for you as a customer is gone for the next 3 months. Yeah. So telecoms desperately don't want you to call the call center. And if you call, then they want to reduce the time. So they what they call the average handling time. And what they also want is what they call FCR, the first call resolution. They really want to solve your problem the first time that you call. Plus, these operators are really, really the call center operators are in a bad situation. I mean, most of the time people yell at them, and so you have to be of a special type of person if you can stay happy working in a call center. So what you really want is make your customers happy, then your call center operators are more happy, and then you don't have this this big turnover in your call centers, and you need less training. Anyway, all kinds of advantages. If you had a semantic platform that could predict what your customers are going to call about, yeah, and then when the customer calls, you already know the three most important reasons why they're going to call, and you already have a script ready to deal with that. So anyway, that's the platform. That's what they're building right now. Can we go to the next screen? Again, I hope you can read it. In the middle, you see a full semantic network of one single customer called, in my screen, John Smith, with about 30, 40 high-level concepts that describe this one particular customer. So anyway, this was kind of the summary of the system. So on the left-hand side, you see the collects collected in real time, and you see that all these events are transformed into a connected graph of business concepts, which is a total, a semantic network. And then once you've fed it through a Bayesian belief network and through your reasoner, you get a whole set of predictions and actions. And what you see at the bottom is you store things like subjective things, like whether someone is a good payer or not, patterns like, oh, this person always pays 2 days late, trends like, okay, this guys really starting to be better when you pace. They actually know where you are at all times. The probability of what you're going to call about. They even store for every customer their social network, so they, not every phone call is stored in the Drupal store, but what is stored is the person that you call with and the frequency of how often that you call with this person. So you can actually do all kinds of interesting social network analysis on it. In theory and in the future, you could have all the places where you normally are, so the geospatial information. Of course, again, you won't do the complete movement history, but at least you can make an abstraction of where the customer usually is. So even in the current system, you have 3,000 to 5,000 triples per person. Yeah, that pretty precisely describes you within the context of telecom and your smartphone and things you do on your smartphone. And then you can make a lot of predictions from that. Can we continue?
Slide 14, right?
Yes. And again, this is normally a little movie. It's now turned into something that's already expanded. So basically, this is the screen that the call center operator sees. On the left yellow thing at the top are the three most important reasons why the customer is probably going to call. So just imagine I call up, and for the call center operator, this screen pops up, and the top screen is she can instantly see, oh, well, these must be the things that you were going to call about. And then what you see at the bottom, and again, it's hard to read here, is the scripts of how to deal with each of these three reasons. And you even see on the left-hand side the most recent events, because if you call, most of the time, you call about something that recently happened, whether it was a bill that you got or a download that didn't work or a device that stopped working. But these events are all known to telecom. And so on the left-hand side, you can see that's these events. And then most of the screen is just the old-fashioned screens that they already had all the time. Can I go one more? Oh, no, this was the last slide. Yeah, so in summary, what MDOS wanted was a semantic platform that knows everything, that wants to know everything it can about an individual customer. It uses ontologies to get information out of the relational databases in the form of triples. And then there's also an ontology of how you want to represent the knowledge about your individual customers. And there is a tool, a graphical user interface, that allows customers to create rules and new ontologies just by clicking in a graphical user interface without ever knowing that you're actually working on an ontology. And the first application is CRM, but there's many, many more applications to come on top of this semantic platform. And I hope to report on that in further presentations later this year. Okay, that's about it.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jan. You know, we're going to be running a little bit long today. Is that okay? And also, I'd like Corey Casanavi.
This is Corey. I'm here.
Hi, Corey. Why don't we just get right into your presentation, where you're going to look at architectures and ontologies and the relationship to business value.
Very good. So just a quick introduction. I'm Corey Casanavi with Model Driven Solutions. Our kind of core competency is architecture along many dimensions, enterprise architecture, services, business architecture, and systems architectures. And we do this for enterprise clients quite a bit for the federal government. And, of course, with any of these large clients, we're dealing with a large number of perspectives, different political factions and boundaries, information that's come from a lot of different time frames and perspectives. And it's our job to help put that together for these organizations. And I want to talk a little about the connection between architecture and ontological approach. Next slide, please.
Is this slide two we're on?
We're on slide two.
Yeah. Pull out the numbers. Oh.
And I'll try and go through these quickly. I know we're short on time here. So these are very complex entities, and we're talking about an architecture, particularly across an enterprise level or a system of systems level. We're dealing with a lot of different perspectives and units, modules, divisions, systems. Connecting anything, how they work, is critical for success in the initiatives that they're supporting. And yet, while there's great tools for various architectural perspectives, the connecting the dots between them is not so good. And so we want these to be able to become more connected and be able to evolve more smoothly. Slide three, please. Slide three. So this is just a little graphic we have that, the information that we're dealing with here comes by many names, right, from business intelligence, enterprise architecture, modeling and ontologies and vocabularies. And next slide, please. Our goal is to federate this information and make it work together more collaboratively. So I don't know if it's just my VNC, but things are coming across slowly here. So the theme that we're talking about this is what we call linked open architectures, kind of along the linked open data theme, but really saying that we really need to look at that as more than just data, but this information flowing about the enterprise. So if you go to slide five, we really see this as a strategic opportunity in that there's really a core problem here, in that this information, this architectural information and enterprise planning information is stovepiped and siloed, and oddly enough, a lot of this information is the exact is part of the programs to end silos. So even our information to correct the silos is siloed. So slide six, we talk about this in terms of a specific an unnamed government agency, because and the goal is to understand their business needs, their business architecture, as well as how that relates to their systems architecture and their data and services. So we looked at that as from a business architecture's point, as information and process services, but also looked at the information processes and services of their technology. And in slide seven, it's just a graphic to put in perspective the number of different viewpoints that this really involves. A lot of times when people are starting an architecture, they're starting from one place and looking at it as essentially the center of the universe. You might have a very process-centric, a business process-centric view. You could have a systems information view. You could have a structural view of the organization. And our perspective is that none of these are the center. There is no center, that we really need to be able to bring all of these viewpoints across business systems and technology perspectives together into a coherent picture. And the practice of doing these type of architectures currently does not involve what I would call in general an ontological approach, and particularly does not generally build on the ontological capabilities. And our perspective is that the type of modeling and architectural work that is done essentially is our light ontologies. We are building ontologies for the business, we're building ontologies for the system, and we're trying to drive value for those, even though those are not the names that are typically used for them. And the capabilities that are provided by the ontology technologies and ontology languages and tools and practices would help us solve this problem of connecting the dots between these different viewpoints. So on slide 8, you'll see something that most of you recognize. This is actually a UML diagram. But what this UML diagram is diagramming is are not objects in a system. They are entities in the domain. This was part of financial system, and understanding what a bill is, what the terms of the bill is, what are the relations of that to other elements. So one of the things that we like to do in our architectural approach is to start with a model of the domain itself, and that model of the domain has different perspectives. One of these is this information viewpoint, where we're not modeling the technology, we're not even modeling the data. We are modeling the domain. We're using associations and UML to represent the connections between the entities, which are exactly the same as the relations that you're going to find in an ontology. Some of the constraints that we put in these are cardinalities, subtyping, correspond very directly to the ontological concepts. So, in fact, we can actually take this information and build an ontology out of it. So that the connection that we see here is to start looking at these different modeling domains, these different modeling viewpoints, as mutually supportive. So if you go to the next slide, number 9, this makes the point that this information viewpoint essentially is an ontology of the domain. There may be some aspects of that ontology that we can express more precisely in an ontological language, and that's something we would like to be able to do. But this forms the basic entities of the domain, the relations, and some of those constraints. So if you go to slide 10, this kind of information viewpoint of the domain is very typical of what you will see in many of the ontologies, particularly OWL ontologies. They are information-centric, but this is just one of the viewpoints that's important to integrate into an architectural approach. So we'd like to be able to build on this ontology of the domain from that perspective, but add other viewpoints as well. So if you look at the next slide, slide 11, this is another part of the same architecture. And what we're expressing in here is essentially a business service viewpoint. The box in the center of financial management is a provider of services, such as property accounting. It's one of those on the model there. And there's a consumer of that service from property management. By understanding the services that are offered by an organization and those that consume it, we essentially start to draw the value chain of the organization and the requirements for how it fits into its community. This is part of the ontology of that organization as well. It's not structural part, it's not information part, but it's about what they do, the value they offer. And inside of these services, we want to be able to connect down to processes, to information, as well as to the goals and requirements that they fulfill in the business. If you go to the next slide, slide 12, this shows a little bit more of the detail. Simply inside of one of those bubbles, we start to see more of the dynamics of this interaction. In this case, we're a bill submission service, like about submitting a bill, getting delivery of it, and these are information that flows between parties. Information flowing between parties is not something that we have a first-class relationship for in and for example, OWL. So we have to build additional ontologies to represent these other viewpoints. And this is part of where we want to start to close the gap, is to start to have ontologies not just for the structure of the information, but for the dynamics, for the process, for the interactions. These elements are going back and forth. This submit bill, for instance, in this on slide 12 here, corresponds then directly to the ontology of the domain. That bill has a model itself, has information, has properties, and we want to understand those. So this is how the dynamic part of the process in the architecture connects to the ontology of the domain and essentially the information that represents it. If you go to the next slide. Likewise, process, obviously very important in both business and technical architectures, is understanding when things happen, the relationship between them, when decisions are made, what information is going in and out of the process. So the process viewpoints are pretty well developed in the architectural languages. We're using UML here. Many people use BPMN. And these process viewpoints, then, we want to be able to understand how these processes connect to the information and the services that we saw on the other side. One of the reasons that we use UML for this, even though it's generally seen as a technology language we use it at the business level, is because we can actually do all of these different perspectives in one tooling environment and make some connections. The connections are far from perfect, and it's far from perfect to be able to do this, but it's the best tool we have right now. And this is where I think there's some opportunity to enhance this with ontologies that represent this type of information. If you go on to slide 13, this just kind of closes that gap and shows how things that we have that are information about the domain, a bill submission, a change, relate directly to the process, because what the processes do frequently is draw on and produce information. This also relates to the vocabulary of the domain. Everything in each of these viewpoints, the information, the process, the services, comprise the vocabulary of the domain. If you go to slide 15, one of the layers that we want to model here is the pure business architecture, which is kind of what I was reviewing quickly with you here. But the same kind of concerns, roles and information models and protocols correspond to things that we're going to find in a systems architecture. So just like we can have an architectural representation of the business, we can have an architectural representation of the system, and we want to be able to draw those connections between them. This is doable within the current tools, but it is extremely difficult. And again, this is more of that connecting the dots that we think is a strong point of ontologies, and if we can bring that into the architectural domain, we can leverage it. Going on to slide 16, this just takes this concept a bit further and shows how we take some of that information from the business domain and we connect it with a system component model so that we understand how components in an information system relate to the business, but also how they connect to each other. So we can understand how the information flows, what the responsibilities are, what the services are offered, and what the processes are inside of those components. And then, as part of our model-driven architecture approach, we also then take that information from the models, and as is suggested in slide 17, are able to take that down and produce the technology artifacts for systems that actually implement it. One of the things that we've seen in some of the ontology approaches is an attempt to use the ontology capabilities, particularly with the semantic web capabilities, and some of the runtime capabilities, you know, to actually implement the system, you know, with the inference live and that type of thing, which is practical in some cases but impractical in others. So in many cases, we want to take the information from the models and produce the kind of normal information system that people are used to, that has interfaces and system components and Java classes and that type of thing. So in some cases, you may want to run it dynamically. In other cases, you may want to produce elements that directly into an IT system implementation. So figure 18 is just a representation of one of those systems. And so you'll see the typical, the high level pictorial representation of, multiple systems that need to be integrated. FTP systems and adapters and user interfaces and databases and all types of things that you're going to have. And most of the guts of what those systems do can be driven by these kind of ontologically backed architectures. And this helps to support data integration, process integration, and sharing of information across boundaries. So in summary on 19, we think the architectures, ontologies are mutually supportive. In fact, we would say that ontologies are an architectural style. It is a way to do architecture. The precision that we can get with ontologies and with being able to express more of the semantics of the domains brings a lot of value to architecture. And on the other side of it, the viewpoints that have been developed in the architectural tools provide a much friendlier, more well-developed way to express information to stakeholders. So when we're expressing processes or services or component models, for example, the tooling that exists and the concepts that exist in those architectural tools are, make a lot more sense to people. It provides a graphical way to understand the domain, as well as having a model that's worked out for that domain. In addition, you can look at automating parts of a system from these models combined with the ontologies, and using a model-driven architecture approach there provides a lot of the value of the ontology without some of that runtime overhead. So our view is that there is the strategic opportunity to bring information about the enterprise, about enterprise planning, enterprise architecture, and enterprise systems together with a knowledge base backed by some architecture, some ontological meat. And this can help to make these connections between the different viewpoints that are currently somewhat fragmented. We're starting to do so. It's the start of a path. We think we've made some progress. And just thought that this kind of view of architectures and ontologies might be something interesting to ontologue. So that was kind of the fire hose approach to that, so I could get through it in a few minutes. I guess I'll
well done.
Open it to questions.
Okay, good. Let me again thank you, and I want to thank all of our presenters today, starting of course with Dave McComb and Ralph and Sanjeeva Nath and Jim Ryan and of course Elisa and Jans and of course you, Corey. I need to take counsel for a second with Peter, just as to how we manage the time and or questioning.
All right, Peter's just typed in a thing saying we can do Q&A in 10 minutes, so if we give ourselves till the top of the hour, hopefully most of you can stay for that, then I think we can run through. We had a few questions on the chat log. first.
Why don't you handle these, Mike? Great.
Yeah, I sort of volunteered to do it, but I'm a bit new to figuring out how to do it. So I think just so we can catch, I think Michael Rushard, you had a couple of questions on the chat board. Do you want to go first, and then whoever else has a question, if you click on the hand icon,
don't type next, but just click it, then it will tell us your next, and I think maybe a couple of others on the chat board. Michael, are you still there? And
thanks a lot. Lots of questions. Yeah, I've got a question up there.
Michael, you would have to use star 3 to come online.
Well, while he's doing it, I'll answer a question I had on there from Bobbin, which was on slide 18, which is that system picture where are the ontologies. For this particular implementation, by the time it got to the runtime system, the ontologies were gone. In other words, it was a pure design time. But we do have other examples where we have had some level of runtime use of the ontologies, particularly for at the data integration level.
Okay. Also, next we have a question from for Dave McComb, referring to page 19 of your presentation with the term GIST 2/3 box, and they wanted to know what that meant under the upper ontology box for GIST. In fact, what is GIST? And Dave, you'll have to do star 3 to answer.
So GIST is our minimalist upper ontology. It is it's freely available through Creative Commons. So if you want to get an upper ontology that's sort of geared toward enterprise business ontologies, seems to be a pretty good place to start. GIST 2 and GIST 3 were experimental extensions we're making to GIST modules, if you will. But since then we've started breaking them into kind of functional areas, you know, sub-ontologies that deal with temporal aspects or, I don't know, there's about 7 or 8 functional areas now that we've expanded it a bit. So that's what that is.
Okay, so, Brian Hoare, are you still there? I just want to pick up the 2 or 3 questions that were in the stream before we pick up the hand, but I don't know if he's still there, and then we'll go on to Michael Rochelle's question. It sounds like he's got his sound pushed out now. Brian, you want to know if there are any case studies of application of Sanjeeva NAP architecture? That's a good question for you.
Yes, that was...
Go ahead.
Sanjeeva, are you there? Okay. I think Michael Rochelle, if you might unmute yourself now.
Sorry, I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'll answer it three ways, actually, quickly. One, so first what we have is a semantic application framework which sits on GenR and basically handles multiple definitions as we talked about in the architecture drawing with the VCOM. It's on source 4, is open source. And related to that is an extension to complement Wiki, a semantic extension called Wikismart, which is also open source. Now, those two in conjunction have been used in a lot of different applications that we are aware of. For example, of constructing, implementing good relations and in-class ontologies, and basically using Confluence Wiki as a to capture medical device data in high, a fair amount of granularity and link it to articles and other research material, either coming from PubMed or other sources. So that's one sort of integration use case there. Then moving away from that sort of outlining examples to what I talk about mostly, we have a product called Teamwork, which is out there in deployment in a number of different places, in U.S. and Europe and Canada. And there people are primarily focused on software engineering, lifecycle management, and so they're managing their all of their sort of integration of requirements, test cases, check-ins, builds, and so on, all of the things across the tool. So we provide connectors to tools like Subversion and Hudson and Confluence and Jira, which is an issue tracking system. And so through these connectors, you're able to capture all of the core concepts and then link them together so you can know which requirement and which software component has what bugs in it and so on. So that's actually a very specific implementation that is in the product and it is out there as a use case.
Excellent. Yeah, I think we just wanted to know that there were people out there using it. It wasn't just excellent. Thank you very much for that. So Michael Urschild had problems with his sound. So he was asking, and he's written the question again, Jan claimed some flexibility advantage on something taking too long to do with an RGB schema. If you're avoiding the need to use schema at all, as some do, then there's no business benefit to the ontology because there's no ontology. What you're really saying is it's the benefit of triples. If you're building ontology as a schema, why are you finding it faster to build than a traditional schema? That's a question for Jan. I haven't done that justice. Very short answer, if you can, please. What's the benefit of ontology versus the benefit of triples, which is what you're saying?
Mike, who is that question addressed to?
It's addressed to Jan.
Okay. Is Jan still with us?
Hi, Mills. Can you – I have my phone turned up to the max, but it's still hard to hear.
No, you're coming through great.
Okay.
Oh, the question Michael Bennett, can you repeat the question more loudly this time?
Sorry, yes. So you're claiming the flexibility advantage in your case study that based on comparison of triples versus RGB schema. Is it a benefit of triples that you're claiming or the benefit of ontology itself?
Well, basically the ontology defines the kind of triples you want to see. So the model is that the person in telecom drags around these things on screen, and that turns into a description of the objects that you want to see. So it writes the ontology for you as a kind of a schema, yeah. And then things that are created by rules follow this particular ontology. So it's used as a schema, but it's a very flexible schema, and you don't know in advance what your users are going to use. And you don't have to write, you theoretically could do this with the relational database, but it would be extremely time-consuming and error-prone just to write these things on the fly and make sure that everything fits with everything else.
Thank you. Excellent. Next question from Terry Longstreth, please.
Okay.
We don't hear you, Terry. Good.
I just figured out how to unmute. the Amdocs picture that we're looking at right now, I couldn't find it in the presentations that were downloaded. And it's got all the proprietary confidential stuff on the trail, on the footer. I was wondering if we could get a summary of some of that information that wasn't classified or restricted.
Yeah. So that's a very good question, actually. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, sure.
Mills, I would actually like to make a short... So what happened this morning that I made a mistake with the time zone. So I thought this started all at 12:30 in the Pacific time, but actually you guys were already working. So I was working on a presentation, but then I just gave the whole MDoc presentation. So what I actually would like is a little bit of time to take this presentation and turn to do a non-confidential version. Yeah, but I'll keep this slide definitely in that you have there.
Mills, thank you.
Could we do that? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, just send it to Peter, and he can post it up. Mike?
Excellent. And We've got one minute left. Ralph,
I mean, well, it's more of a wondering. I'm wondering what the nature of what we've just done means to people. And I don't know who's on the call, of course, but apart from the people that presented, but the industry is needing to be informed about this world in a careful way. And I've seen confusion many places on understanding the topics we've been touching on, and I look to a group like this to maybe help the industry. And the nature of what we've done is, to some extent, is parade ourselves in front of this audience, and I tried not to do that, but limited time, I didn't have the slide I exactly wanted. So, and I suppose I'm asking a question for those on the call in the 2 minutes that remain. Where is this going for people? Yeah. And
can I have one quick stab at that, and then throw it to others? As part of the ontology summit, the theme is to make the case for ontologies. And what we've tried to do, and I think very successfully with this session, is get as many different kinds of thing that people call an ontology, both from the point of view of, you know, what technology makes them call it an ontology. Is it triples? Is it OWL? Is it UML, like Corey's thing, versus what kind of applications? Is it a solution, or is it a business domain model? We've tried to cover the whole breadth of that.
Okay.
And when we draw this together, we want to be able to show what are the different kinds of things that are ontologies and what are the cases that can be made for those. So the aim of this case study stream has really been to try and spread as widely as possible what people are doing with ontologies of one form or another.
And apropos of that, for example, Ralph, those quad charts, those 2x2 diagrams that you gave, you know, particularly that first one that, you know, kind of went from lightweight to, you know, strong, you know, modeling from, you know, the design time to machine time and looking at, you know, where the value gets generated. As the way you reflected on it, those kinds of maps, I think, are really valuable.
And you can do a good job of making that into something very effective, very appealing. Yeah,
I'll get a hold of James, and we'll see. Yeah.
I think we'll draw together those quad things from everybody, and that thing of Ralph that Neil just mentioned, and make one slideshow to present at the face to face that draws all those together. So,
Okay. Thanks. That was helpful.
Okay. So I think we're at a point where we need to, you know, kind of bring things to a close.
Yep.
Would you like to...
Can I have a second? Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
Handing back to you, Mills. So I've...
somebody else is on the line here.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Jones, one second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I say something? So sure. I have a... If you go to our front website, then there is a completely non-confidential version of the MDocs presentation, plus much more material, plus videos by MDocs itself about this system. So I would prefer if people would use that confidential version. Sorry, thank you.
Okay, great. And and destroy the other one because it does contain confidential. Can you send a copy to Peter so he can post it?
Sorry. Yes, I will do that.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
I sent an email saying I need to replace mine because I got a company wrong. I put the wrong company name against one of the case studies, yeah? So.
Okay. I got a copy of it. I think you sent it to Peter as well, right?
Yeah. So will you look after that?
I will do.
Mechanics, yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay. So everyone, this is the, you know, we've now done, you know, two of these sessions, where we've covered probably, you know, 15, you know, different case examples, either in crazy form or more extended discussions. And, you know, depending on, how the organization committee goes, we may do, you know, try to do one more session before the summit. But any comments that you have, you know, feel free to, you know, get to Mike Bennett or myself so that, you know, we're going to be, you know, trying to distill this out and also include it as part of a write-up or a composite of things. Again, I want to thank our speakers today. I think you guys, you know, this has been really, really, you know, good overviews and some depth in some areas that I think have been very illuminating. And I want to thank everybody. It seems like everyone sort of stayed with the whole program all the way to the end. Okay.
We'll see you all next Thursday at the next session in this ongoing virtual summit that's going on every Thursday between now and the face-to-face in April.
Excellent. And goodbye from Mike and myself.
Yeah, thanks, Mel. Goodbye, everyone.
and thank you for hosting.
Thanks.